WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. If you pay attention to the billboards around Chicago, there's a chance you've seen a close-up photo of someone's bloodshot eyes. Blurry text reads, "Eye syphilis is serious." The AIDS Healthcare Foundation launched these billboards as part of a new campaign to raise awareness about syphilis. Syphilis was almost eradicated in the U.S. Almost. Today, there are more cases of the sexually transmitted infection than there have been since 1950. So how did we get here? And what can be done to slow it down? Dr. Kimberly Stanford, Associate Professor of Medicine at UChicago, joined us to fill us in. I started by asking her to clear up the difference between a sexually transmitted disease and infection.
We updated our terminology several years ago, but they all refer to the same thing.
Okay. So what is syphilis and what causes it?
Yeah. So syphilis is a sexually transmitted infection, or STI. It's caused by a bacterium known as a Treponema pallidum. It's a little spirochete. And you can pass it by any kind of sexual activity. If you have a lesion, you may not even know that you have it. And if somebody else contacts it, they can get syphilis that way.
Mm. So there are different stages, I understand. So I want you to sort of walk us through what syphilis looks like at each stage. Symptoms, what do they look like?
Sure. So this is a very complicated question, and I could go on about this for a long time. But the bottom line, so syphilis has kind of three main stages.
Yeah.
The first one is primary syphilis. That happens a few weeks after you contact it, and that gives you a painless ulcer. The problem with this is that it's often in places you can't see it, and you can't feel it because it doesn't hurt. So many times this goes, you have it, and you don't even realize you went through this stage.
Okay.
The secondary stage comes a month or two after that, and that can be so nonspecific. The famous, kind of the well-known symptoms of that are the rash. We often see that rash on palms and soles you hear about.
Like a reddish brown.
Yeah, it can be like little bumps. But it can also just look like a viral illness. You can kind of feel feverish and fatigued and kind of just feel like you're getting coming down with something. And so sometimes that also goes missed. And then after that, usually it becomes asymptomatic and you can carry it around for years with no symptoms. And then in some cases, it continues forever with no symptoms. But in other cases, you'll get to something called tertiary syphilis, where you can end up with any number of complications. You can have psychiatric problems. You can have nervous system problems, difficulties walking. You can have problems with your blood vessels. It can cause, we call it the great imitator because it can really look like just about anything.
Really? And when you're carrying it around with no symptoms, can you spread it too?
For the most part, we consider that once you're in that late latent stage, no. Early on in the infection, yes, in theory you can. But importantly, if you have no symptoms and you're carrying it around and you become pregnant, you can give it to your fetus, your baby.
And we'll dig more into that. Talk more then about the dangers of living with syphilis undiagnosed. So you have no idea.
Yeah. So I think the biggest danger is that it then progresses into one of those serious complications. And those are very, very serious complications. And they can cause death if untreated.
Wow.
So really the biggest issue is if you don't get treated and it progresses and then you end up with these terrible symptoms, it would have been much easier to just treat it in the first place.
Right. And I want to make sure the key there that you just said is that syphilis is treatable.
Absolutely. Very, very treatable with widely available and inexpensive medications.
Yeah. How do doctors test for syphilis?
So it is a blood test. It's pretty easy blood test that you can get really at your doctor's office or at the emergency department or at an STI clinic. So it's just a blood test. And then we compare that with your history as well. So we do have to know a little bit about whether you've ever had syphilis before.
The reason that we're having this conversation today, doctor, is because, as I mentioned earlier, the number of cases is rising. I mean, it shocked me to even, I hadn't heard about cases in a while. And so to know that the numbers are this high right now, I was very surprised. These stats are stats that we haven't seen in decades, right?
Yes. Yes, it's staggering. We're at the highest levels, like you said, in decades. And we had really had a lot of progress. Back in 2000, we had really made so much progress. We saw syphilis largely go away to the point that many of us were not trained about it in medical school. And as we kind of came up through school and our medical training, I never saw a case of syphilis. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people are now kind of scrambling to learn about how to recognize it and what to do about it, because it really had, for the most part, gone away.
Yeah. To your point, I'm looking at a bar graph right now of syphilis cases. This is over the past 75 years. So when you look at the graph, it starts at 1950, sort of goes to 2022. In 1950, it looks like there were more than 200,000 cases. Then the numbers went down for a few decades. There's a spike in the late 80s, then a decline in the 90s. Then the numbers have been climbing again since 2000. We're now back above that 200,000 cases. So quite a roller coaster ride, doctor.
Yes.
What do you make of that spike in the 80s and then this much bigger spike that we're seeing now?
So that's a complicated question. I mean, I think there are social trends that play into a lot of this. Of course, at the very beginning, we discovered penicillin, and that's what got the initial large numbers to go down. And then I think we did, you know, at that time, I think you can tie this all back in many ways to public health campaigns. So we realized it was an issue, got everybody treated, the numbers started to go down.
Right.
And then there became the, you know, sort of more sexual freedom, birth control pills, all of those things that came in the, you know, the 70s, 80s. And so we started seeing people being less careful about their sexual practices. And then along came HIV. And when HIV came at first, people were scared. And so all of a sudden, now people were being more careful again. And when you're more careful, not only do you prevent HIV transmission, but you prevent transmission of all the other STIs, including syphilis. So then we saw that kind of decrease again. And then HIV became a treatable disease, and we started having HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, so prevention for HIV. And at the same time, syphilis numbers had gotten so low that I think public health to some extent let our guard down. We stopped doing those campaigns for publicity. We stopped making sure everybody was getting screened because the numbers had gotten low, and so our priorities and our funding moved elsewhere. And so then it started to creep up on us over the last 20 years as people have been sort of less concerned about the safe sex practices, knowing that HIV wasn't as big of a concern, that it could be treated and prevented so well. And at the same time, we have less resources going towards syphilis because it had largely disappeared. And so, you know, with limited resources, they were sort of turned elsewhere.
I see. So who does syphilis impact the most? Give us the age and racial breakdown, if you will. I know earlier you talked about babies getting it, right? Newborns.
Yes. Yes. So syphilis can affect anyone, and we see it across the lifespan. I think what we are seeing is that this is an infection that is affecting people who have limited access to care. So we see this affecting people in much the same patterns as many other conditions. So people who are traditionally marginalized, people who are underinsured, who may not be accessing routine primary care for their annual visits. And what that means, too, is racial and ethnic minorities. We've traditionally thought of syphilis as an infection that is more, it more affects men. And so women have been underscreened, and now we're seeing a huge increase among women. And so I think what we really need to start thinking about is how do we reach these populations that really have, they're disproportionately affected by many conditions because they have difficulty accessing care.
Yeah. In Chicago, Black residents bear a disproportionate share of the burden, representing 86% of congenital syphilis cases that were diagnosed between 2020 and 2022. So to your point, yes, affecting racial and ethnic minorities the most right now. So, doctor, keeping all of this in mind, poor prevention efforts, lack of access to health care, what do you think is missing? What are the solutions here?
Yeah, so I think it's a combination. I think public health funding, which is now coming, we're now seeing more and more of that for campaigns for awareness, for testing, for screening for folks, really making sure that healthcare personnel know that this is a problem, because there's still an issue with even people in the healthcare field not realizing syphilis has kind of made this resurgence. So educating people that they need to be testing their patients, and educating consumers, educating communities that they need to make sure that they are seeking out this testing, that they are using safe sex practices to prevent it in the first place. And that means condoms every time. But also that when they see their doctor, that they ask for screening. And that when folks get pregnant, that they make sure they get in for prenatal care as quickly as they possibly can. Because again, this congenital syphilis, which is the syphilis that is transmitted to babies from mothers, is 100% preventable. The earlier you treat it, the better the outcomes are. So really, if you are pregnant or think you could be pregnant, really getting in to see someone for prenatal care as quickly as possible.
So tell me more about what you're doing. You and your public health research colleagues at UChicago Medicine, you've implemented and you're testing a new syphilis screening strategy.
Yeah. So what we realized is that a lot of these people who have trouble accessing outpatient care, the ones who are having trouble with primary care or getting into prenatal care, the place that they do come into care is the emergency department. So it may be that they have a sprained ankle, or they have a cold, or they're pregnant and they're having pain or bleeding and they don't have a doctor already. And so where they go is the emergency department. And so we thought, well, this is our opportunity to find these people and make sure that they get the screening that they need. And so we implemented routine screening. That means everybody who comes through our emergency department has the opportunity to get screened for syphilis.
So if I go into the ER with a broken arm, would I be asked to get tested for syphilis?
Yes, you would. And you can decline. But the idea is that if we're asking everyone to get tested for syphilis, then nobody feels singled out. So nobody feels like we're, you know, making some kind of assumption about them, or we're trying to find out about what their sexual practices are. It makes people feel uncomfortable. By just screening everyone, then you don't have to make people feel like there's something about them that you're targeting.
It's just routine.
It's routine, and it's made it very acceptable. And what we've found is that almost everybody that we have diagnosed with syphilis didn't come in with symptoms of an STI or concerns of an STI. So we know we would have missed people if we weren't doing that routine screening.
Yeah, the study you worked on, it looked at 2-year periods before and after implementing this screening program. So this has been a while that you've been working on this. And those results that you just mentioned, I mean, what do they tell you?
So what they tell me is that most people who have syphilis are not having symptoms, or don't perceive themselves to be at risk. So they're not coming in asking for STIs testing. And so what that tells me is that we need to really be looking anywhere where there's a lot of syphilis in the area, in that neighborhood, we need to be screening everybody. And there have been studies in the HIV realm looking at whether people believe that they're at risk. And sometimes the ones who are most likely to turn down screening are the ones who have the most risk factors. And so, in fact, destigmatizing it by talking about it, by screening everybody, is probably the best way to really find as many of these diagnoses as possible.
Sounds a little bit scary, too. It just sounds very hidden.
It is.
This illness, right?
It is.
Hard to capture. So looking ahead, doctor, who's responsible for ending this epidemic? Who needs to step up? Is it government? Is it local, state, federal levels, healthcare providers like yourself?
Yes, all of the above. All of the above, I think. I think we need a concerted effort with health departments who can partner with individual hospitals and clinics to make sure that people are getting screened and treated. Syphilis is it's easy to treat, but the actual infrastructure needed is complex. So if I'm diagnosing someone in my emergency department, they're not coming back to me to get treated. So I need partners in the health department. I need partners in outpatient clinics. And so we need that network of people all working together to really make this as efficient as possible. And we need funding. We need funding to research what the best way of getting this information out there is, what the best way of getting people screened is. And we need funding for DIS workers, for people to go out into the community and find people to get treated, because it really is, the volume of patients is so high that it's a lot of workforce we're going to need to deal with this.
Do you see these numbers coming down anytime soon, doctor, just from your view?
I hope so. When I started this work 5 years ago, it felt like nobody was really talking about syphilis yet. And now I hear people talking about it all the time. And I hear it on every level. I hear it on state levels, on national levels, on local levels. And that gives me hope. That gives me hope because I know that there are lots of really smart people all over the country thinking about how to deal with this epidemic.
Right.
And so I think the numbers will come down, but we need to work hard to get all those programs into place.
Well, leave us with this. If people do want to get screened, where can they go?
So your best place to get screened is your primary care doctor. Your primary care can screen you. There's also health STI clinics that are run by the city that you can get screened at. Or you can go, if you're pregnant, you can go to your OBGYN. Or if you're going for a routine annual exam, you can get screened there. The bottom line is, whenever you see a healthcare provider, if you want to get screened, just ask them about syphilis and they should be able to screen you.
That's Dr. Kimberly Stanford, Associate Professor of Medicine at UChicago Medicine. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This episode was produced and mixed by Micah Yason and edited by Dan Tucker. Every week we drop conversations about health trends, so make sure to click subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.